from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrath Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk to an author from Fort Wayne about her brand new novel, The Girl on the Golden Coin.
I'll get a preview of an event that brings together Dance Kaleidoscope and the Art Museum.
And I'll find out about a new musical being created by the Phoenix Theater. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Fort Wayne author Marcy Jefferson grew up in an Air Force family, and all that moving around inspired her interest in history. A trip to London a few years ago ignited in her an interest in 17th century history when Francis Stuart captured the hearts of Louis XIV, Charles II, and James II. Sharon Gamble invited Marcy to tell us how she brought Francis Stuart to life for her novel, The Girl on the Golden Coin. Marcy began by reading a passage.
Francis Stuart, among many things, she was known for something a little bit unusual for women of her time. She sometimes dressed as a man. Now, this gave her a little bit of freedom to move around. I think it really originated as sort of a court theatrical where she would play the part of a man in a little court theater, and it really sort of was found very entertaining. You know, the kings really enjoyed this kind of fun diversion. And so she did this from time to time. Many portraits are painted of Frances Stuart in her male attire. And I have a scene from about midway through the novel where Frances is dressed as a man at a birthday party for the king at a rival's apartment at the palace, and she gets herself into a little bit of an adventure as she's leaving the party. So I'll go ahead and begin.
Great.
I took a glass from a footman and stepped onto the balcony overlooking the privy garden. It was enclosed as an aviary, and birds scattered as I leaned against the bars to catch my breath. As I sipped my wine, I caught sight of a lady rushing through the grounds. Something about her gait was familiar, and when she reached the garden door, I recognized her. Prudence, the little fool, will get herself arrested. Prudence, by the way, is Frances Stuart's Quaker maid. The lifeguards let her slip out, and she turned left toward the King Street Gate, the open city, and Westminster. I moved through Castlemaine's guests as casually as I could. When I reached the stairs, I flew down and went through a closed door onto King Street. She disappeared through the King Street Gate, and I walked that direction so as not to raise suspicion from the guards at the Privy Garden wall. At the gate I peeped through. The gables on the many taverns and houses towered overhead, making the road seem narrower than it was. I pulled my cavalier hat down tight on my head and slipped out. I ran after her, keeping close to the tavern walls. Prue, I called, but she rushed onward. A scantily dressed woman emerged from the shadows. Oi, gent, here's your lady. Startled, I stepped aside, tripping into the sludge of the road. I ran ahead with only the candles from the tavern windows to light my way. I caught Prudence by the arm just before she rounded a corner. Come with me. She spun around, struggled, peered at my face, then looked guilty as sin. Sorry, m'lady, I was just going to meet my friends. Your Quaker friends? The militia will beat you. Do you want to get yourself transported to the Americas? She tried to break free, but I wouldn't let go. You're coming back with me. Just then, two militiamen stepped out of a tavern across the street. The sounds of beer mugs clanking and laughter spilled out behind them. You got one of them Quakers, m'lord? One of them called. We can help you. I froze. Should I run? Draw my scabbard? Nay, I called in a deep voice. The scantily dressed woman reappeared. A tavern window opened. Nay, I said again. Just a two-penny whore who thinks she's worth three. Prudence stopped struggling and gaped at me. The men laughed and went back inside. I hauled her by the arm all the way down the street, through King Street Gate, through the guards at the privy door, and under the torches of the privy garden before I released her. Go back to bed, I said, short of breath, and if you value your life, you won't do that again. That's just it, she muttered. I do value my life, and I think I ought to be able to do as I wish. You certainly do. I stared at her a moment. I promised King Charles I'd look after you, so you can't. And that's it. So you get a little bit glimpse of 17th century London and the dangers of the streets outside of the palace walls and a little bit of the religious conflict going on at the time.
Yeah. You know, I love this character, Frances Stewart, as you've made her come to light. I would love to, you know, be friends with her, go out to dinner with her. And she's certainly, you know, she's protecting a woman who's her servant here. And, you know, she doesn't really need to do that. She is in a social and political position where she could just as easily turn Prudence in for the transgression of being a Quaker. But she doesn't. She protects this young lady.
And that is very much Frances Stewart's style. She's a very loyal person, very loving. She makes a great many sacrifices for the betterment of her family and her country.
So you moved around a lot as a child. Is that what got you interested in the history of all the places you were moving? Because one of your parents was in the Air Force, right?
That is correct. And yes, I moved all around the South. I lived in the Philippines two times, and I lived in Yorktown, Virginia. And yes, I do think living in all of these different places really sparked my interest in history and culture. And I just felt the need to learn the background of a place once I tried to set roots down, and I think really particularly Yorktown, where the Revolutionary War was sort of won there. It was the final battle. That's really where I got really involved in not only American history, but, you know, if you study American history so far back, to a certain point it kind of becomes British history. We were all British at one point.
Right.
So I really kind of just kept on, you know, sort of studying farther and farther back. And that's, I think, where the interest in the British monarchy sort of came about, once I started studying the British history.
Well, most of our listeners, I'd venture to say, are fans of Downton Abbey on our sister PBS affiliate. So, you know, it's not surprising that we're all kind of drawn to, whether our families came here from Germany or Italy, there's something about the motherland of England that we're just fascinated by the period drama of it. And life is just enough different under a monarchy than it is in the United States that becomes a source of just complete fascination and curiosity for most of us.
Definitely. You know, we don't have monarchs per se. You know, we don't have a ruler. We have our president, who is, of course, very popular and very public figure. We have superstars. We have movie stars. We have big business who certainly wield a certain amount of perhaps political and certainly financial power. But there's just something so intriguing about a royal who they claim their place because of their ancestral blood and their connections and their history. And we don't, being only a couple hundred years old ourselves, we Americans don't have that long history, those roots that go back hundreds of years like these aristocrats do. And you know, so I think it is just natural for us to be intrigued. And we're not the only ones. Of course, most of the British love their royalty.
Sure.
They revere them, and they're very proud to be able to look to these figures. And, you know, really back, it was always this way. Back in the late 17th century, the time of Frances Stewart, the royals were superstars. There were no movie stars. You know, there were a few theaters, and there were a handful of actresses who became famous, but they were the talk of the town. They were what there was to talk about.
And long before the current British tabloids that look into every potential scandal, there were rumors, and Frances Stewart is right. I've got to be careful how I talk about this, because there's some secrets revealed as the novel goes along. So if I start to say something, just stop me, okay?
Sure.
But she's right there in the crosshairs of the political alliances and misalliances between France and Great Britain.
That's right. These are the two major political players of the century, King of France, Louis XIV, and Charles II of England. In 1660, they both sort of came of age and began their personal rule, and they were in the center of all of the wars that happened. They were fighting for, you know, trading powers. And Frances is a very rare kind of figure. She is one who sort of walks the line between both, because as a British royalist, after the civil wars were lost, she was a royalist. That meant she was on the king's side. The king lost those wars, and so she, with the king, was exiled from England for a long period until finally England got tired of the Puritan ruler, Oliver Cromwell, and they restored their king. So she, when she was in exile, went to France, and so she got to know the French court and nobles, and particularly the French king, Louis XIV, known as the Sun King of France. And, you know, he kind of, I won't want to give too much away,
sure,
but he falls in love with her, and she has, you know, secrets to keep, like you mentioned, and people to protect, and she does reject him, and that makes him angry, and he uses her then, sends her to England, her homeland, to the her very, very distant cousin, Charles II, to kind of spy on him and become, you know, sort of a figure to help him, Louis, align with Charles, and he calls on her to stop a war. So she's very involved in everything that's going on. She's sort of a little-known spectator that her story hasn't really been told very often. So she's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So you've clearly spent years researching this. Tell us about your primary documents. Were there letters you were able to see and read, or what were some of your source materials?
Well, actually, I did spend years researching this, too long probably. There's one biography by Hartman Hughes, written, gosh, I think it might have been published in the 1930s, and she hasn't had a biography published since. But it was an excellent, excellent starting point for all of my additional research. He didn't really expound on her years in France, but I was able to sort of piece that together by studying the biographies of her family members, other people that were exiled with her in France. But yes, there were certainly diarists. Samuel Pepys was a famous diarist, writing during the Restoration period in England, and he kept very close tabs on Frances Stuart. He was fascinated by her. There were wills and letters between courtiers that I was able to read, and like I said, I sort of found out that they existed by reading biographies and material that I could get my hands on here, and then I was actually able to, through the internet, connect with some archivists in England who sent me transcripts of these letters that were just mentioned in biographies. I actually got to read the entire thing and found out a little bit more about you know, what she was doing and even what she was wearing back during her adventures in late 17th century.
Yeah, and I don't mean by talking about the research to in any way make this imaginative act any less important, because you've figured out how to convey, you know, the texture of fabrics, what the clothes looked like, what the street smelled like. So there's a great act of imagination behind this novel.
Yes, you're quite right about that. Historical fiction is sort of hard that way. You know, I did push my imagination into overdrive, really, for each and every scene. For every historical fact that I studied, I sort of uncovered a new set of questions and led to more study. And, you know, it's one thing to know what happened in a period, but it's another to decide how to make, how it made a character feel, and yet another to know how to make the reader feel it through the right choice of words. You know, I felt like I couldn't let Frances Stuart walk down a hallway without knowing if her footsteps would echo or fall on soft carpet, whether she was nervous or bored, and how the walls looked, and yeah, even what it smelled like. Those are things that we experience. That gives life texture.
If you had lived in that era and had known Frances Stuart, what do you think you would have liked to have done together?
Oh, what a great question. First of all, I would have to get a smallpox booster.
That's right.
Because it's quite a different time. It's quite a dangerous time, like I said. So I would definitely opt for the safety of Whitehall Palace. But I might have to brush up on my courtier skills and learn how to be manipulative and sort of tough. But if I did have the opportunity to just hang out with Frances for a while, I think I would choose to go back to the time during Queen Catherine's birthday ball. I won't give away too much. It's
sure.
Just sort of a moment in the novel where Frances Stuart, you know, she wore this silver lace gown, and she had all of these diamonds. She was spotted being the best dancer, and, you know, it's a moment in the novel where that her struggles, her external struggles, are sort of behind her, and she was unaware of sort of the internal struggles that are about to fall upon her. It was like a moment of triumph for her, and that would have been a great time to go back and kind of hang out and check out her jewelry and ask to borrow a gown and learn how to do those English dances. But I would really just try to take the opportunity to sit down and talk to her, have a glass of tea with her, or a cup or a dish of tea, as they would have had. And I would ask her if I guessed all of her secrets and got her story right.
Sharon Gamble with Fort Wayne author Marcy Jefferson. Her novel is set in the 17th century and reimagines the life of Frances Stuart, who captured the hearts of Louis XIV, Charles II, and James II. It's called The Girl on the Golden Coin, and it's available at bookstores now. You can learn more at marcyjefferson.com. That's Marcy, M-A-R-C-I, Jefferson.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Dance Kaleidoscope's David Hochoy can find inspiration pretty much anywhere, so creating dances based on paintings at the IMA wasn't a stretch at all. Travis spoke with David, dancer Jillian Godwin, and the IMA's curatorial assistant, Leslie Anderson Perkins, to learn more about this collaboration.
Leslie, Jillian, David, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having us, Travis.
Absolutely. David, let's start with you on this. Since this is your choreography that's been inspired by work at the IMA, how did this all come about for you?
You know, Travis, I've always had a very strong connection to visual art. And back in the 1990s, Dance Kaleidoscope did a couple of programs at the IMA. We call them Three Painters, and all of the pieces were based on paintings. Some of them were hanging at the IMA at the time. And I thought now would be a really good time to revive these pieces because, first of all, they're beautiful. And second of all, I think the IMA was interested. Yeah, because they're interested in opening back up the Toby and wanting more people to be in there. And I thought it would be a really wonderful opportunity for us to showcase ourselves there again, and especially because the IMA really is being very, very cooperative this time. And what's going to be wonderful is that the gallery is going to be open so that people can arrive early and go see the paintings before they actually come to the theater. So they get a first-hand glimpse of what those pieces are based on.
And to be clear, the dance is taking place in the Toby.
Correct.
Jillian is not going to be dancing around in the galleries.
No. I need a sprung floor for that.
So, well, let's talk about the two pieces that these are based on.
Right.
The first one, the title of the dance piece is Heart of Joy, and it's based on a Georgia O'Keeffe painting. Tell me about that painting.
Georgia O'Keeffe is known as the mother of American modernism, and she did a series of floral paintings where she basically took these pictures of flowers and blew them up immensely, and she created really these landscapes of flowers. The Jimson Weed is her largest, and it's a brilliant, brilliant painting. It has a great deal of energy. It practically explodes at you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very, very inspired by it. This piece, Heart of Joy, has a lot of Georgia O'Keeffe in it. The girls wear these wonderful dresses that when they twirl, they flare out, and they look just like the petals in Jimson Weed. And the music is very modern. It's Philip Glass. And there's a lot of American landscape in this piece in the Georgia O'Keeffe painting.
Leslie, this Georgia O'Keeffe painting is one of the best well-known ones that the IMA has. Tell me a little bit more about it.
Right. It's a highlight of our collection of American 20th century art. It is a large, essentially a cluster of four Jimson Weed blossoms in mm-hmm. various stages of bloom. Really beautiful. There is a lot of movement to the piece. What's interesting about it is the commission. It was, at the time, the highest price paid to an American artist for a commission.
Really?
And it was hung in Elizabeth Arden's exercise room in her her salon on Fifth Avenue. And so there is a connection
here. So this painting
here
is used to having people move around it.
Absolutely. It was meant to encourage movement.
Wow, that's pretty neat. Did you know that part of the history, David, beforehand?
Yes, yeah. I just found that out, actually.
Yeah, that's really fascinating because there certainly is a lot of movement in the painting. And what a cool connection to
it
make
is.
With that.
It's fantastic.
Now, the other painting that you're using is the Theodore Roszak. And this is a really different work. It's in some ways an abstract piece. In some ways, it's almost surrealistic. We were talking about it beforehand. I mean, I sort of envisioned it as it's almost like pieces of old recording instruments, mechanisms in this sort of limbo desert landscape. It's a strange painting. Actually, Leslie, why don't you tell me a little bit about it, and then we'll talk about the piece that David's created and Jillian's dancing in.
What we see in this work is a girl kind of tickling the ivories with one hand, and on the other, she's propping up a very thought-laden head. It's kind of an old motif popularized by Albrecht Dürer of this creative genius that has perhaps too many ideas to articulate all at once, but very much abstracted. We actually see what could be these forms that could be abstracted forms of her ideas. Above her head. They also resemble components of an engine. So there's a little bit of technology here mixed with this appreciation for music.
It's an interesting piece because they do look like they could be mechanical pieces, or are they supposed to be the sound, or what is it going on? I know, David, you've really been intrigued by this piece before.
Yeah, you know what? The reason why I was attracted to this piece, believe it or not, was there's a great deal of emotion for me in the piece. The expression of the girl, she's quizzical, and yet there's a sadness about her, and yet there's a lightness in her face. She has many sides to her, and why is she at the piano? I felt it proposed a mystery that I needed to solve, and that's what led me to choreograph on it.
Jillian, talk to me about dancing this piece, and because you are the girl at the piano, really, in this piece.
This is the second time I'm actually doing this role. The first time I did it was in 2008, and I was a lot younger then, and I was a nervous wreck on stage, actually, the last time. We did it with live musicians, and it was at the Clues Hall Theater, and I'm really excited to get to do this again now that I'm a little older and have come into my artistic self a little bit more. The girl, I feel, goes through a myriad of emotions throughout the dance, and I'm on stage the entire time, and I guess I'm just trying to figure out every little part that happens to me. And I know for me, the deepest place that I go is just this heartache, this angst that I have a very dear friend of mine that passes away, and I try to find connections in my own life to really help me express what I want to say as I'm going throughout the piece, joy or sadness or disgust. I mean, it's a whirlwind. It's a ride. it really is.
A lot happens to her in the piece.
Yeah. A lot happens. And you just got to keep trucking through and try to especially perform it and get your point across the best to your ability. So,
you know, I find it fascinating that, I mean, dance is inherently, in some ways, a very abstract art, and yet you're using dance and essentially creating a narrative to really, for yourselves and for the audience, understand what this somewhat abstract painting is.
Right.
It's kind of a backwards approach that it sounds like it's just going to end up being a fascinating product.
Also, when you layer the music on top of it, you should know, Travis, that I'm using the Rachmaninoff Variations on a Theme of Paganini. So, I mean, those are also abstract variations. I mean,
sure.
They don't really pertain to anything at all. But, you know, when they you put it all together in the mix, it becomes very, very, very dramatic. So we do tell a story, and I think it's very inspiring about why is the girl that way? It turns out she is an artist, and music is her life.
Leslie, let me ask you what it's like, working as a curator, working in at the IMA, and I know you're in European and American art, having another artist, David and Jillian, interpret this work that you already know in such a creative way.
I mean, it's interesting to see it from another perspective. For instance, the Rorschach, you know, you can see it as this piece that's been inspired by European avant-garde movements. You can talk about it in a kind of autobiographical context. Rorschach himself was really quite interested in music. He was a violinist. But you start thinking about it from another perspective. Now you're kind of looking at it more as a kind of aural experience that has been translated from a visual representation.
And with the O'Keeffe as well, I'm sure you must be, you know, here's a painting that you've probably seen 1,000 times and yet seen in a new light.
Absolutely. I mean, you can really see the movement of the piece, almost imagine the sound accompanying it. And I think that these works were very well selected.
David, does it make you want to select some more paintings to work from?
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah.
You know, and actually, we did a conversations last week, Thursday, at the museum, and it was fantastic because we sort of dissected both paintings and for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But they came up with an idea that the next time they want to pick the painting and give it to me, so I don't get to pick it.
That could be an interesting challenge.
That would be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
It would be completely, totally unexpected. I wouldn't know what to do with it.
Hmm. Jillian, how about you? I mean, for you, are there any paintings that you're looking at now thinking, boy, I wish I could dance that?
Oh, no, I'm inspired by just the world around me. I mean, I can take inspiration from a guy walking down the street to the sunset. I mean, everything can be inspiring to you in some way. I don't try to just pick one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just allow everything to just fall into place with me.
Excellent. Well, there's certainly lots to be inspired by at the IMA, and this sounds like just a terrific concert. DK at the IMA, picture this. I want to thank the three of you for coming into Art of the Matter today to talk about it.
Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For having us.
Travis DiNicola with IMA's curatorial assistant Leslie Anderson Perkins and Dance Kaleidoscope's Jillian Godwin and David Hochoy. DK at IMA, picture this, takes place May 1st through the 4th at the IMA's Toby Theater. You can get more information at imamuseum.org, imamuseum.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Did you see the recent little photo in the Indianapolis Star that had a man pushing a lawnmower on a beautiful sunny day? And the caption said, the only bad thing about the good weather is ... yard work.
I did see that. I did see that, and I immediately thought of myself.
Yeah, me too. I spent an awful lot of time last weekend in the yard trying to get ahead of the weeds. Anyway, if you need some relief from your yard work, we have some suggestions on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
What do you got?
Well, you know, I mean, this is a big weekend for arts events.
It is.
Especially Friday night. You've got the Stutz Artist Show and Installation Nation up at the Art Center. Next week, though, there's another event going on at the Stutz Art Gallery, and it is Recycle Parts 2, the Raymond James Stutz Arts Gallery, and brings together the Stutz Artists Association, Zip Speed Weaponry, and Prism Art Supply, and it is a celebration of art and the bicycle. And it's following last year's very fun, successful event, and they've been partnering with some local charities, including Freewheeling Community Bikes and IndyCog and World Bike Relief. And so what they're doing next Friday the 2nd, they are having 20 local artists, actually even more than that, who are creating works that somehow have to deal with recycled bicycles and connect with bicycles and using recycled bicycle parts. And so the artists have been making these pieces. They'll all be on display, and then part of the proceeds go back to charity. It should be very, very fun. It's part of IDOTA First Friday Gallery Tour that night. And so this is from 5 to 9. On next Friday night, again at the Stutz Building. And Sun King's a sponsor as well, so that makes it doubly fun.
Franken Cycles. Love it. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Hey, if you're hearing us on Thursday night, remember that while the big sort of boisterous night at the Stutz Center for their spring open house is Friday night from 5:30 to 10:30. You can also, if you buy a ticket to Friday night, you can come back on that same ticket, or you can buy a ticket just to Saturday. That's the 26th. If you're hearing us on Saturday morning and you didn't make it last night, you can still go 2 to 7 this afternoon, the Stutz Artists Open House. And it's actually a little bit quieter, a little bit easier to talk with artists, and a little bit more family-friendly
Saturday afternoon. Not quite as much as the party Friday night. And on that note, too, Sharon, even though Installation Nation had their big opening on Friday night, if you're listening to us Saturday morning, that continues with more events on Saturday afternoon into the evening.
Indeed. Hey, the arts run this weekend continues with the Philharmonic Orchestra of Indianapolis in a program called Portraits of Darkness and Light, with a wide variety of music that takes you through that theme. The concert is at the Pike Performing Arts Center on Sunday at 3 o'clock. And it's just a nice, lovely way to spend a Sunday afternoon. All sorts of great soloists as well. So you can learn more about that by Googling Philharmonic Orchestra of Indianapolis.
There you go. Hey, something kind of cool going on with NASA and the Indiana.
There's always something
State
cool
Museum.
Going on with NASA.
Exactly. Well, there's a special exhibit that's focusing on the International Space Station that is at the State Museum through June 29th. And to kick it off, there's a lot of events that are going on this weekend with astronauts and special presentations and events and workshops. And so there's going to be things going on at Earth Day Indiana at the White River State Park on Saturday, the 26th, from 11 till 4. And then on Sunday, the 27th, the WTHR-TV Health and Fitness Expo at the State Fairgrounds from 10 to 5. They're going to have some stuff connected to this. And also some things going on at Purdue on the 30th, and then back at the State Museum on May 2nd. You can get lots of information if you go to... You ready for this?
I'm ready.
NASA.gov/destination station. How cool is that?
That's pretty sassy for a government website, a government URL.
Well, that's NASA for you.
There you go. Hey, Ansel Adams had a way of depicting nature in his photographs that made you appreciate the great wide open spaces. Did you catch that segue?
I did.
NASA,
I
space,
like that.
Wide open spaces.
Mm-hmm. Nicely done.
And there is a selection that he made of his own work, a wide representation of his different eras of his work, on view right now at the Idlejord Museum. And you can learn more about that exhibit and some special programming at idlejord.org. But definitely, if you love photography and you haven't been to an Ansel Adams show, or even if you have been, you owe it to yourself to get over to see this spectacular show at the Idlejord.
Cool. Hey, one of my favorite galleries in town isn't necessarily open all the time, but when they do, they always do shows worth checking out, and that is the Monster Gallery, and located just sort of off of Fountain Square, and that's Mab Graves and Larry Endicott's space, and they have a new show, Anti-Gravity, with new paintings by Justin Cooper, coming up next Friday, May 2nd at 6 p.m. If you go on Facebook and look for Monster Gallery, you'll find
wow.
out all about it.
It's the monster theme calendar. I talked about Frankenbikes earlier.
There you go.
Scary. Hey, speaking of galleries and exhibits, the William Rasdell Show just opened this week at the Arthur and Glick JCC. The show is based on a trip he took, and it was a 3-day trip to Israel to capture the contemporary life of Ethiopian Jews in their new homeland. And so it's got a lot of really interesting context to it. And that show is up for a while at the JCC, so you can go out there and check that out.
Very cool. Hey, some really good news for Hoosier Salon. They are going to be moving and open up a new gallery in Carmel Arts and Design District. They just announced this, and the new gallery is supposed to be open by next weekend on Rangeline Road. And this will be a good location for them and to show off the work. It's a not-for-profit gallery, of course, and they do a great job in promoting, especially Indiana artists who focus on landscapes and plein air painting, as well as sort of more traditional styles, but really beautiful work. And this is their new gallery, so congratulations to them.
There's a local painting instructor named Ellen who has come up with some really great workshops, including Couples Paint Night, What's Your Relationship? Vision Painted. That's coming up on Saturday, May 17th from 6 to 8. You need to email her or go to, I'm sorry, call her or go to her website for more details and find out a little bit more. But her description is this: grab your partner and some friends and head to Inspire for a unique and fun experience. I'll launch your group into an adventure where you get to explore and then paint your relationship essence. This experience is a combination of inspiration, creativity, and experiential process. And she recommends booking this two-hour experience from 6 to 8 p.m. and continuing the fun at a local Broad Ripple restaurant or hotspot. You can learn more about this unusual opportunity at elleninspires.com. Ellen, the woman's name, inspires.com, or call 201-1399, 201-1399.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Well, yeah. Sharon, it is time to get back to our yard work.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Please say it isn't so. The weeds are out there again. They're coming to
get me. They're calling your name. So we will be back next week with more things to do on the calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
When he died in 2001, Dr. John C. Lilly was described by the New York Times as a neuroscientist and writer who explored human consciousness, dolphin communication, and the borders of reality with the showmanship of P.T. Barnum and the infectious zeal of Jacques Cousteau. The films Day of the Dolphin and Altered States were both inspired by his studies. Next season, you'll be able to see a world premiere musical based on Dr. Lilly's work at the Phoenix Theater. Sharon Gamble was curious about the project and invited the Phoenix's playwright-in-residence, Tom Horan, and its musical director, Tim Brickley, in to talk to her about how they chose Dr. Lilly and how you write a musical with someone you've just met.
Tom, I'm going to start with you. Explain what the National New Play Network is.
It's an organization of about 20-plus theaters across the country, and they pool their resources in terms of money, energy, to support new work. And they have a number of different programs to help develop that work, commissions and situations where they come and show plays together. And one of those programs is the Playwright-in-Residence, where there are three Playwright-in-Residence at different member companies for the course of 1 year. And it's a one-year program. And I'm currently one right now for the Phoenix Theater.
Why was the Phoenix a good fit for you, or vice versa?
I think I fit very well with the writers that they've done over their 30 years are the same writers that I grew up with reading the theater. Oh. That when I read, I was like, I want to be a playwright. Reading Sam Shepard, reading Carol Churchill, those were the writers that spoke to me.
Those are such different voices you've just lined out there. Wow. Okay. Were you tempted to go into another career, or did playwriting hit you kind of early?
It hit me pretty early. I was one of those people who did theater in high school and performed and did stuff behind the scene. But sort of the way theater combined with my creative writing classes, I did theater in undergrad and then spent about 10 years in Chicago doing theater, and then recently came from UT Austin's MFA program.
Where you're keeping things weird, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So I understand that working in a more conservative environment, you decided to take as a positive?
You know, in fact, even though Austin is weird, it stays very true to me that being in a more conservative state and doing art in some ways feels like doing God's work. You know, like I really believe those people who are doing art in Indianapolis, in Indiana, are doing amazing things, speaking to those communities and what it means to do art here, versus having a New York-centric or a coast-centric approach to art. I think it should be done everywhere, and the people who are doing it here are doing amazing things.
So this this joint project, where did this start?
Well, for me, I came on and Brian, the artistic director of the Phoenix Theater, had a number of projects, and one of them, he said, when you get here, you should meet Tim Brickley. He's been our musician for years and years, done a number of different shows for us, and he's been talking about doing a musical for a while. So if you can help work on something with him, that would be wonderful.
And Tim, I mean, this is it's like an arranged marriage in a way. Two artists from different backgrounds, different viewpoints. How did you figure out shared language, or are you in the middle of figuring that out right now?
I would say we're in the middle of that.
Yeah, cool.
Tom came up with the initial idea that we have taken down the path on, and it's been fabulous so far. But it is, yeah, I normally collaborate with friends and people I've known a long time, so So it is interesting getting to know somebody and working at the same time.
So lunches together, coffees together, not even talking about the project, is that a little part of the education?
A little bit. We first met, we had a few conversations, and then we have taken a while. We probably started in August, even slowly just having conversations about what the project might be. We weren't even settled on the subject necessarily. We started to do a lot of history-based work.
Mm-hmm.
It's often a good starting place for me. And I think when we found this guy, our subject, it both clicked for us in a certain way.
So who is the guy? And tell us about the guy and then about kind of the shape of the musical that's on its way to being birthed.
Great. I'll start us off. So there's a scientist named Dr. John C. Lilly, and he is known primarily for three things. The first is inventing the isolation tank, which is also known as the sensory deprivation chamber.
Uh-huh.
Came up with that. And then he spent some time trying to get dolphins to speak, which is usually the moment everyone sits up and is like, he tried to get dolphins to speak.
Dolphins to speak their language or ours?
A little bit of both. He was trying to find a way to connect humans speaking to dolphins. And then the last thing he's known for is he was one of the forefront on the LSD movement from when it was first discovered. Afterwards, and I think he has found a way to combine all of those three things at various places, and is just a fearless searcher in his entire life. And I think on the surface that we are both sort of captivated, and then the project has been, how do we go deeper? How do we see where this guy is coming from? How do we really understand his work?
So all of those kind of three highlights, and this gentleman is still alive.
He's no longer alive. He lived until when?
He died in 2001, born in 1915.
Okay, and I feel like we should probably establish this since we're in the shadow of Eli Lilly and Company. No relation.
No relation.
That we found anyway.
No.
But it kind of feels like there's some connection among those three themes about finding inner intelligence or about finding a way to communicate or something, right?
Yeah, I think from a young age, he was really concerned with the big question, what is the nature of this reality we all find ourselves in? And he got a conventional medical education, went to Dartmouth Medical School. Before that was at Caltech studying physics, and then worked as a government researcher, sort of neuroscientist for a long time, helping during World War II, helping pilots navigate in high altitude and ways that, you know, to keep the brain working in these stressful situations.
Well, he's actually was trained and, it sounds like, adept in three completely different fields.
Oh, yeah.
That's
he was
astonishing.
He was a really, really bright guy. And then, in the mid-50s, I think in a quest just I think that when he developed the sensory isolation tank, which for those who don't know what that is, it is you float in salt water that's body temperature, and there's no sound, there's no light, and it's just sort of a meditative aid in some way. And
have you done that, by the way?
I have. There was a tank center here in Indianapolis throughout the 80s. You've done it as
I
well.
Have. Tom? Yeah.
I haven't, but I meant
no pressure or anything, but you know you have to by way of research.
Totally. I'm actually looking for one. I would love to do one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Lilly was that a couple movies were based on his work, but he really didn't participate. So there was the movie Altered States that was directed by Ken Russell and had William Hurt in it from 1980. Mm-hmm. That was about sort of the isolation tank and psychedelics. And then Day of the Dolphin, which was Mike Nichols' second film he directed that starred George C. Scott mm-hmm. as a dolphin researcher. So those are two ways that Lilly sort of impacted the mainstream.
And what's fascinating for me, because he was obsessed with brain and the mind, is no one knew at the time what would happen if you stuck a brain in a box and gave it no stimulation. Half the people thought it would just shut down and you wouldn't do anything. And then he sort of was theorizing that there was still something going on once the brain had no external stimulation. So he was really in uncharted territory.
So I hope you guys heard this interview recently on Radiolab about sleep. So the crazy thing about dolphins, and this relates to brain stimulation, because dolphins are mammals and they have to surface to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And so researchers were trying to figure out how do they sleep then? And so actually half their brain sleeps at a time,
which
sounds like something right out of this fellow's research.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah, he was convinced by his early experiments and spending time with them that they were truly sentient beings, since their brain was actually larger than a human brain, and on many levels, brain size determines intelligence. He was really at the forefront of getting the world to sort of recognize that dolphins were more than just, you know, something that was caught in a tuna net.
Yeah.
That they were, and very, he really changed the way the world thought about them.
So you've got this amazing compilation of material, and so how have you decided, or how are you making the decision to tell this story, to structure it? I mean, obviously, the most straight-ahead thing to do would be a chronological biography. But that may not be the most interesting thing to do.
We're definitely exploring something that, I think this was Tim's word, is more prismatic in how it's approached to his life. We're definitely not going to tell a straight-ahead biography. In fact, I don't think it suits him. That I think he's making these constantly different connections over the course of his life. And I think the question of how we're going to do that exactly is one we're right in the middle of wrestling with, and is actually... And how we're balancing all the details and these wonderful little anecdotes with the essence of who he is and trying to reconnect to that.
And then there's that whole other layer of how do you tell it musically? So do you have are you picturing rock? Are you picturing more world music, jazz? I mean, I'm asking you this because you work in all these languages yourself, Tim.
I wish I had that answer, Shannon.
Ask again later.
Yeah. No. It is. It's going to be mostly rock, even though he was born in 1915, and a lot of his life sort of he was a couple decades before the whole upheaval that happened in sort of Western culture in the 60s. I mean,
sure.
He sort of played all that out in the 30s and 40s and was a few steps ahead because of his age. But yeah, the more I get into it and the more, you know, we've both been researching on our own very deeply, and he's it's just so fascinating. It's almost like this science fiction. It's like the more you find out, you can't believe it. So I just keep coming back to the whole David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust sort of character of this, which only relates musically. Yeah, it's going to rock.
So was Dr. Lilly a loner? Was there a spouse, partner, children, siblings, or did he just, because he sounds like he's kind of apart from the pack, was he kind of off on his own a lot?
I would say that you're on target. He was both, and that was a conflicting, you know, that was something he dealt with his whole life, because most of his, you know, being a researcher and especially using himself, you know, he used to say, "My body is my laboratory." So, in using himself as his subject, he, a lot of it was being alone, and he had a lifelong quest to connect with people. But he was married three times, and had children who went on to great careers, some of them in related fields.
And he had adopted children and stepchildren. He had very complicated relationships with people.
Yeah, the adopted children are all young, attractive women. So I'm when he's in his 70s. So I'm still researching.
Oh, yeah, there'll be some rock and roll in this, I can tell. Tim, I want to give you a chance because I know this is you have a date slotted for this? Production's going to be in the fall, right?
You know, we have to finish it first, but Brian and the Phoenix have been very supportive, and it's probably looking for later next year. So probably not the fall, probably early winter would
and we're
be
still
my
looking,
guess.
Still looking for some funding to help get this puppy off the ground a little?
I'm sure.
I'm sure there's people at Phoenix that would like me to say yes.
Yeah, okay.
We are sure.
Well said. There's a musical coming up, Tim, that you're working on right now, though.
There is. You know, the Phoenix, especially over the last 5 years, we've been doing quite a lot of interesting new musicals. You know, Avenue Q and Next to Normal and Spring Awakening and Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson and. This one that opens at the end of April is called Spun, and it was developed by the Bloomington Playwrights Project and is a two-person brother and sister rock and roll musical kind of based on like sort of a rock band like the White Stripes. They weren't brother and sister, but it was a duo. And it tells this sibling tale, and there's a live band in it, and it's a really interesting show. So we're looking forward to that.
Sharon Gamble with the Phoenix Theater's playwright in residence, Tom Horan, and its musical director, Tim Brickley. Their musical about Dr. John C. Lilly, no relation to our pharmaceutical friends. The musical will be part of the Phoenix Theater's 2014-15 season. You can learn more about the Phoenix at phoenixtheater.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out what is marching into the Children's Museum.
I'll get a preview of Emmanuel Axe's upcoming concert at Butler's Schrott Hall.
And I'll go backstage with the Young Actors Theater. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.